David, talk about arriving back in the city on Tuesday. Kind of what possessed you to come into the city on Tuesday from the West Bank Bureau, and the conditions in the city for the first couple of days for you and your team of reporters.
Well, first I want to say, you know Manuel's been through a lot when he describes something as a small tsunami. I don't know what that is. good morning. This is a wonderful turnout. I know a lot of people went around the corner to see the president speak, but I think you all came to the better event. You know, Manuel said something that really is, all these guys have reflected on something that you need to understand. During Katrina, sometimes the only information you had was what you could see with your own eyes. There was no way to call someone. There was no way to get any context. You couldn't say, oh, what's it like on your side of town? You need to understand that. So when we woke up Tuesday morning at the paper, all we could see was water. From where we were standing, it looked like the entire city had gone under. And the water was still moving. I never realized floodwater has a current. It's going somewhere, and it was rushing past the paper. We had no way of knowing how much time we had. James was in on a meeting. We quickly convened, and we evacuated. And at the point we're pulling away, we're thinking, well, we've got to get out of here. And the plan was to go to the West Bank Bureau just over the bridge. We have a bureau in Gretna. They were still letting white people through, at least at that point in time. And we got off on the bridge, and we went over there, and it was complete chaos. And I wrote about this in today's paper on the op-ed page. The Times-Picayune was not unlike any other place. Some people panicked, some people didn't. There was a range of reactions. And in that parking lot, our editor, Jim Amos, was trying to just keep people calm, get them back on the trucks, and go to Houma and Baton Rouge. James had already headed up to Baton Rouge. It was very important that we get people in different places. But as we drove up over the Mississippi River Bridge to go to the West Bank, I looked down the back of the truck. I think I was on the second to last truck out. And I saw people walking on St. Charles and, you know, Magazine Street and dry streets, which we had not expected. It was pretty deep around the paper. And I just turned instinctively to Mike Perlstein, a reporter writing next to me, and I said, you know, I'm not leaving. And he says, what? I said, I'm not going to leave. And I'll never forget what he said to me. He said, well, whatever you're doing, I'm with you. And so we basically hatched a plot that we needed one of these trucks. Now, that sounds like a small thing, but you need to understand that at newspapers, executives in the front office don't want to turn over big, expensive pieces of equipment to journalists.
And they might not ever see it back.
And really, their fears weren't
wisely
founded, because it was a full 2 weeks before we destroyed that truck. And they found out when I called. I didn't really say what happened to the first one. I just called up and said, I need another truck. But in that parking lot, I remember approaching Jim, who was understandably concerned about the safety of our staff. And I sort of grabbed him by the shoulders and I said, Jim, you know, this is the biggest story in the world. We cannot all leave. And Jim, who's a great journalist, sort of like looked at me and I'll never forget, he asked me, he said, well, how are you going to eat? How are you going to file? As if I've got this all worked out, right? Well, we'll just stop at the store. And I was like, and I said to him, I don't know. I said, but you know what? We're going to find a way. We'll find good New Orleanians who will help us out. I had driven uptown the day before. One of the things the national press gets wrong about this all the time is the hurricane went through, and we left the paper and went out and reported. And I had driven through uptown, so I knew, I had heard generators. I knew there were people uptown, and so the roughed out plan was we're going to head uptown and see what we can find out. And Doug McCash was standing maybe 10 feet away, you know, eavesdropping like all good reporters do. I could see his ear cocked to one side because it was the editors. My superiors did not want anyone to be forced to go, which makes sense. Well, Doug, of course, stepped forward right away. And there were other people. There was a whole group of people who said, you know, I'll stay with you. And we had quite a group. I often say I don't know the history of breaking news Pulitzers and what the teams have been comprised of, but I will say there's probably never been one quite like ours. We had the art critic, the music critic, the religion writer.
The editorial page editor.
I was a sports editor. We had the editorial page editor, the deputy editorial page editor, a couple city desk reporters, and then later a sports copy editor and our Saints beat writer. And so this was quite a group. And we headed back into the city, and here was our plan. We had no idea what we were doing. We had no notebooks. We had no food. We had no provisions. We had nothing. And we decided we would drive to Terry Troncalli's house, who lived on Perrier Street, and we would try to set up a base there. And before we ever made it, I drove right into the infamous Walmart looting, as it's happening. I drive in, and actually, at first, I thought it was a relief effort. True. I turned the mic and said, oh, look, they're handing out supplies. Let's stop and get some. And right about that time, I saw a guy push a 60-inch plasma screen TV by in a grocery cart, and I went, maybe not. And to our credit, we unloaded that truck, and these guys went into that store and covered that story and took pictures of police looting, walked up to police officers who were looting, and asked them, what are you doing? I mean, it was a very gutsy thing to do. They were confronted by the police. Our photographer heard some people yelling, the Times-Picayune's here taking pictures. Let's go out back and take care of business. We ended up in a big ethical debate about whether we should take some supplies or not, and we decided not to. And you know why we didn't want to? Because we just felt like, A, we'd have to put it in the story, and we didn't want to do that. And B, we just weren't desperate enough. But we did. That was the first story we filed. It was written on the back of envelopes and on pieces of paper, and it was filed thanks to a Times-Picayune subscriber. Pure luck. We pull up to Terry's house, and an elderly couple across the street is terrified. They've been left behind, and they're there, and they see this big truck pull up, and then they see, at first they're concerned, and then they see a bunch of harmless-looking people like us jump out of the back with reporters' credentials. And this is amazing, but the gentleman had a Bell South phone line that was still working. And I said to him, I said, well, if we can use your phone line, you know, I'll share any information we can with you, and if you need to get out of here, we will get you out of here. And he said, that's a great deal for him. And it was thanks to this man's phone line that we were able to tell our stories and transmit our photos on day one to the rest of the world. And we did end up evacuating them. We got them out of New Orleans over to the West Bank and up to Baton Rouge where their kids came and picked them up.
Shortly after you got there, a police officer arrived. What did he have to say?
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. I'm sitting there, and a police officer pulls into the street. This is when we moved to another house. Because keep in mind, we're staying on the move because we're hearing the myths and rumors that everybody else is hearing. We're hearing there's armed gangs roaming the street. We weren't really seeing it, but we were hearing it. So we were trying to pick the right locations. So we pick another house over on Audubon Street, and we're just about to set up the bureau when this police car pulls in, confronts me, and says, who are you and what are you doing? And I tell him what I'm doing. I said, I'm setting up a news bureau in that house right there. And he says, oh. He says, are you armed? Well, I'm thinking the guy is trying to keep guns off the street. And I said proudly, no, we're not armed. We're reporters. And he said, oh, well, can you make yourself armed? And I'm like, well, how am I going to do that? He goes, well, where's your – I said, he goes, do you have any guns? I said, I'm not really a gun owner. And so we called – we contacted – I don't even remember how we did it. I think it was our photographer's radio. You know, every news organization has a photographer who sort of goes native during certain events. And ours was Alex Brandon,
Commando,
who was in full camouflage gear,
yes,
and had been embedded with a SWAT team. So we reach Alex on the radio, and he's already gone into military lingo. And I said, Alex, the police are telling me to get guns. Can you help? And he says, what's your 20?
Translate what that is.
And I said, what? He goes, where are you? I said, well, just speak English, Alex. And so I tell him where we are. Within 20 minutes, true story, an unmarked black SWAT car pulls in with three SWAT officers in full body armor and our photographer in full camouflage, and they give us a .357 and a shotgun to keep until things settle down, as well as a little primer on how to fire the guns. The number one tip was don't put the shell in the shotgun chamber. You want to keep it not loaded so that if someone comes to the door, you can go, and the guy goes, usually that'll be enough to scare him off. And I said, well, thanks a lot for your help. Of course, as journalists, as soon as we got inside, we were much more terrified of the guns than we were of anything else. And I'm glad to say we never needed them.
I wanted to ask each of you before we take questions, and we want to leave plenty of time for your questions and have a conversation with you. But each of you, starting with you, David, how has Katrina changed you as a journalist?
You know, I've been asked that question so many times because in our business, you're just taught to be dispassionate. You're taught to be arm's length. And all that teaching doesn't calculate the worst natural disaster in the history of the country hitting your house. I mean, your exact house, your friends' homes, your colleagues' homes, the place where you live, and it's not the same. You cannot resist getting involved in the story. You can't resist becoming part of it and really wanting to do what you can to help. And, you know, you couldn't ride through town in that newspaper truck if you were me and see kids who didn't have water or anything, and we would hand them our fruit cups, our water, anything we had, because we knew we had the ability to get more and they didn't. And I think it definitely changes you in that way, and it gives you a different perspective on what it's like to be on the other side of this, to cover something and to be covered. And by that I mean all of the misconceptions about what happened in New Orleans, all of the incorrect reporting about what the challenges are in our levee system and is it the city's dead and all that. You get defensive about it. And I think that's been the range of emotions I've had in the past year.